Fake Heritage Yeshiva Discipleship Program. We are going to be doing a teaching in this session on the subject of who is the house of Jacob. In looking at this subject and answering this question, we need to understand that there is a literal house of Jacob who is at Mount Sinai. As written in Exodus chapter 19, verse 3, "And Moses went up unto God, and the Lord called unto him out of the mountain, saying, Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob." This would be the literal house of Jacob. However, we're told in Luke chapter 1, verse 33, that Yeshua will reign over the house of Jacob forever, and of his kingdom there will be no end. Yeshua is going to reign over the redeemed house of Jacob forever. Christianity commonly calls the redeemed house of Jacob those saints and who have accepted Yeshua as the Messiah and thus become a part of his family. We need to realize that the scripture talks about a literal house of Jacob and a redeemed house of Jacob. And in this session, we are going to examine the association and connection between the two. It is because traditional Christianity hasn't understood the relationship between the literal house of Jacob and the redeemed house of Jacob. This is how they've come up with that the Old Testament is just about the literal house of Jacob, and they give a new term for the redeemed house of Jacob. They call it the church, or Christianity is the commonly used terms that is used. And then in seeing that in the New Testament, the things that are promised to the redeemed house of Jacob parallels and is connected with the promises to the literal house of Jacob in the Hebrew Scriptures, that is how the church has come up with what they call spiritual Israel. However, those who embrace what is called spiritual Israel come to the conclusion that God is done with the literal house of Jacob. So the church has struggled even to now to get the proper connection between the literal house of Jacob and the redeemed house of Jacob, and that's what we're going to try to unravel in this session. In this session, our objectives and what we're going to be covering is as follows. We're going to learn that all believers in Yahweh are commanded to see themselves as if they were redeemed from Egypt. Number two, we're going to learn that the literal house of Jacob who were redeemed from Egypt consisted of the physical descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and also a mixed multitude who sojourned with them. Number three, we're going to learn that the literal house of Jacob were saved or redeemed by the grace of Yahweh when they by faith put the blood of the Lamb upon their doorposts. Number four, we're going to learn that one Torah was given to both the physical descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, as well as the mixed multitude who sojourned with them. Number five, we're going to learn that the literal house of Jacob was divided into two houses known as the house of Israel or the northern kingdom, or Joseph or Ephraim or the ten tribes, and the house of Judah or the southern kingdom. And this happened after the reign of King Solomon. We're going to learn, number six, that the literal house of Jacob is likened in the Bible to an olive tree. Number seven, we're going to learn that the house of Israel or the northern kingdom were also known as the house of Joseph, Ephraim, the house of Israel, and Samaria. These aren't the only terms for the northern kingdom, but these are primary terms. Number eight, we're going to learn that the house of Judah or the southern kingdom are referred to today as Jews. Number nine, we're going to learn that all Jews, meaning all those from the house of Judah or the southern kingdom, are Israelites because they're from the house of Jacob, but not all Israelites, that's meaning the northern kingdom or the ten tribes, they are not Jews because they are not from and of the house of Judah. Number ten, we're going to learn that the northern kingdom, or the house of Israel, was taken captive by the Assyrians, and the southern kingdom, or the house of Judah, was taken captive by the Babylonians. Number 11, we're going to learn that it's the rule of the Messiah to restore and to regather both houses of Israel, and he will rule over a redeemed house of Jacob forever. Number 12, we're going to learn that the redeemed house of Jacob is likened to an olive tree. Number 13, we're going to learn that the redeemed house of Jacob consists of members from the literal house of Jacob and also those from among the nations. Number 14, we're going to learn that the literal house of Jacob is visibly recognized today by most people and are referred to as being Jews. And the world calls the redeemed house of Jacob Christians. Number 15, we're going to learn that the ministry of Elijah will bring restoration to the literal house of Jacob and the redeemed house of Jacob in the end of days, and they will, when Messiah comes, become one. The literal and the redeemed will be one and the same when Messiah comes and he sets up his kingdom. Number 16, we're going to learn that the literal house of Jacob will unite with the redeemed house of Jacob and return to the land of Israel in the end of days. And number 17, we're going to learn that the Messiah will rule over united house of Jacob, and they will keep his Torah or his commandments during the Messianic era. That's what we're going to learn, so let's look at the scriptures which teach us these things. In 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 1 through 4, Rav Shaul, or the Apostle Paul, who is writing primarily to non-Jewish believers in Yeshua's Messiah, starts out by telling them that they should not be ignorant that all our fathers were under the cloud and that they all passed through the sea. And they were all immersed unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea. They did all eat the same spiritual meat. They did all drink the same spiritual drink. I want you to notice that Paul emphasized, and he uses the word all five times. In saying that we would not be ignorant, five times he uses the word all regarding what we're not to be ignorant of. And he says that all our fathers were in the cloud, they all passed to the sea. They were all immersed into Moses in the cloud and the sea. They all did eat the same spiritual meat. They all did drink the same spiritual drink. What event is Paul referring to? He's referring to the historical Egyptian redemption. And referring to the historical Egyptian redemption, Paul is telling primarily non-Jewish believers in Yeshua as Messiah to don't be ignorant that they are to identify with that event. Then he goes on to say in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 4, at the end of the verse, for the rock that followed them was the Messiah. It was the Messiah who brought and redeemed his people out of Egypt. So, if we do what Paul instructed these primarily non-Jewish believers to do, when he says, don't be ignorant that all our fathers passed the sea, do you realize that all our fathers passed through the sea is not literally true? Because my father and my grandfather didn't literally come out of Egypt. The Apostle Paul's father and grandfather didn't literally come out of Egypt. And your father and grandfather didn't literally come out of Egypt. So if our father and grandfather didn't literally come out of Egypt, why does he tell us, don't be ignorant, that all of our fathers came out of Egypt? It is because it is a Torah or a Hebraic concept. And Paul was actually teaching from the Torah when he is stating this thought. And he is referring to Deuteronomy chapter 29, verses 12 through 14. Or Deuteronomy chapter 29, verses 12 through 15. Deuteronomy chapter 29, verses 12 and 13. The context is he's referring to the covenant that is being made at Mount Sinai. And speaking of that covenant, in Deuteronomy 29, verse 14, he says, neither with you only do I make this covenant and this oath, but the covenant and the oath at Mount Sinai is being made with him that stands here with us this day before the Lord our God, and also with him that is not here with us this day. I want you to notice that the covenant at Mount Sinai is being made with two groups of people. It's being made with those who are there, and it's also being made with those who are not there. Which means, if you are in covenant relationship with the God of Israel, even though that you were not physically there, you were there, according to the Torah. And because non-Jews, especially today that believe Yeshua is Messiah, have separated themselves from the Hebrew Scriptures and the events of the Hebrew Scriptures, thinking that those things happen to another people under another covenant, they do not presently see themselves as coming out of Egypt. That's why Paul made a special point to tell and to say, don't be ignorant, that the God of Israel sees, and you need to see yourself as if you actually did come out of Egypt. This same thought is also expressed in Exodus chapter 13, verse 8, which says, "And you shall show your son in that day." This is referring to the commandment regarding the telling of the events of the historical Egyptian redemption, which we celebrate through Passover. And the commandment is to tell your son in that day that this is being done because of that which the Lord did for me when I came forth out of Egypt. But do you realize the son in that day did not literally come out of Egypt? But there's a commandment in the Torah to tell your son that that event happened to him. That you're to tell him in that day. Well, in that day is also an allusion to messianic times, because the term for the messianic era is the day of the Lord. And this is idiomatically referred to as in that day, or at that time, speaking of the day of the Lord or messianic times. So therefore, when Messiah returns and sets up his kingdom, we will be celebrating Passover, and we are also instructed to tell our sons that the redemption happened to them. But we're told in Jeremiah chapter 16, verses 14 through 16, that in messianic times, when we are talking about the redemption, it won't be from Egypt. It's the end of the exile of the end of days, on how the God of Israel gathered his people from all the nations where they were scattered. So telling your son in that day that he came out of Egypt is not literally true. If it's not literally true, why is it a Torah commandment to tell your son that he did come out of Egypt if he literally didn't? It is because it is a Torah or a Hebraic concept. Well, if we do what the Apostle Paul wrote, that non-Jewish believers in Yeshua's Messiah should do, which is to see themselves as if they came out of Egypt, that means when you and I, as believers in Yeshua as Messiah, when we came out of Egypt, do you know where we went to? We went to Mount Sinai. And it tells us in Exodus chapter 19, verse 3, that at Mount Sinai was the house of Jacob, as it is written. And Moses went up unto God, and the Lord called unto him out of the mountain, saying, "Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the children of Israel." Well, from watching movies like The Ten Commandments and from going to Sunday school class, I wrote in my mind that those who came out of Egypt were the Jews, and those that came out of Egypt was the physical descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And one day, the God of Israel opened up my eyes, and he showed me from Exodus chapter 12, verses 37 and 38, that it was more than just the physical descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob who came out of Egypt. For we're told in Exodus chapter 12, verse 38, that a mixed multitude went up also with them. But wait a second. How is the mixed multitude regarded and referred to as a part of the house of Jacob, which is what is said in Exodus chapter 19, verse 3. Well, that being the case, when Exodus 19, verse 3 is speaking about the house of Jacob being at Mount Sinai. Those who were actually there were the physical descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who put the blood of the lamb upon the doorpost, as well as the mixed multitude, that is the non-physical descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who put the blood of the lamb upon the doorpost. But how does the mixed multitude, that is the non-physical descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, how are they referred to as a part of the house of Jacob? The answer is the mixed multitude is regarded as being strangers, sojourners, adopted, or they were grafted in. Well, at Mount Sinai then, did the God of Israel tell Moses, "Now Moses, I want you to take the physical descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and put them on one side of you, and I want you to put the non-physical descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob on the other side of you, because I'm going to make things a little bit more easier for the non-physical descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I've just got to give them two commandments. They're supposed to love me and love everybody else." Is that what he did? No. What he did was, the commandments that were given at Mount Sinai was both for the physical descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, as well as the non-physical descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. For we're told in Numbers chapter 15, verses 15 and 16, that one ordinance shall be for you of the congregation, and also for the stranger that sojourns with you, in this case the mixed multitude. And this is to be an ordinance forever in your generations. As you are, that is the native born, or the physical descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, as you are, so shall the stranger be before the Lord. One Torah and one manner shall be for you, and also for the stranger that sojourns with you. Therefore, we're told here in Numbers chapter 15, verses 15 and 16, that it's an ordinance forever that the native-born and the stranger, the sojourner, is to have one set of instructions for both of them. Do you know how difficult this has been for the people who claim belief in the God of Israel to understand these verses? Orthodox Judaism says, "Oh, no, 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 no. The commandments are just for us Jews. And if you're not Jewish, you don't need to keep all the commandments. God's made it easier for you," Orthodox Judaism says. "You just need to keep seven, the seven Noahide laws. And that's it. That's all that you're obligated for." There was one set of instructions for non-Jews, but another set of instructions for Jews. Well, what has traditional Christianity said? They said, "Oh, you know, the commandments at Mount Sinai, those are just for the Jews. And that was for another covenant. It's not for Christians because, you know, we just got two things that we need to do. And if we just do these two things, that means we've done all the other. If we just love the God of Israel and love everybody else, that means we have fulfilled all the other." Does that mean, I mean, let's think through what they say. Does that mean if you help an old lady across the road, which is like being nice to your neighbor, that if you help an old lady across the road, that you just ate kosher? All the commandments fall under the category of loving your neighbor, telling you how you love your neighbor, telling you how you love the God of Israel. But in order to show the God of Israel that you love him and show your neighbor you love him, you got to do the other commandments. Because that's your detailed instruction about how you actually love the God of Israel and love your neighbor. Well, Messianic Judaism has a difficult time with this too, because they say, "Well, you know, the Torah, the commandments, that's just for native-born Jews and Jewish believers. But if you're a non-Jew, it's really okay. And no, you're encouraged to eat pig. You're encouraged to keep Christmas and Easter. And it's better for you if you stay in your church and follow the Pope. You know, this following the Torah is just for us Jewish believers. But you know what? I kind of think that Numbers chapter 15, verses 15 and 16, where it says one Torah is for the native-born and for the stranger, I think that's what it means. And so I think that the same commandments were given to me, because I'm in covenant relationship with the God of Israel, as was given to the physical descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. In redeeming the children of Israel out of Egypt, we are told that it was done by the God of Israel having grace upon his people in delivering them. In Exodus chapter 3, verses 20 and 21, it says, I will stretch out my hand and smite Egypt with all my wonders, which I will do in the midst thereof. And after that, he will let you go. And I will give this people favor. The word favor there in the Hebrew is chen, which means grace. I will give this people grace, that is the Strong's number 2580, in the sight of the Egyptians, and it will come to pass that when you go, you will not go empty. So how were they delivered? By the grace of the God of Israel. But even though his grace was present, did every physical descendant of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob come out of Egypt? The answer is no. It was just those who put the blood of the Lamb upon the doorpost. So even though his grace was present, it also required something besides grace. It required faith. And the faith was acting upon what was delivered to the people from Moses, that came ultimately from the God of Israel. And that was, they were to put the blood of the Lamb upon the doorpost. Why was that such an act of faith? Because Egyptian society had many gods. And one of their many gods, they regarded a sheep as an Egyptian god. So therefore, it would not be what they would call today politically correct to take something that somebody else regards as their god and to go out and use it for your endeavors, and a belief that's outside and would become in conflict with how they viewed it from their religious perspective. And so it did require an act of faith. In Exodus chapter 12, verse 3 and verse 7, it is written, speak to the congregation of Israel, saying, in the tenth day of this month they shall take to them every man a lamb, according to the house of their fathers, a lamb for a house. And they shall take of the blood and strike it on the two side posts and on the upper door post of the houses wherein they shall eat it. I want you to realize then the way in which the God of Israel, which earlier in this session we looked at 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 4. Who was it that brought the children of Israel out of Egypt? It was Yeshua the Messiah. He was the rock that followed them. So how did Yeshua redeem his people from Egypt? He did it by grace through faith. Therefore, it's the Torah that teaches that redemption comes by grace through faith. Therefore, in Ephesians chapter 2, verse 8, where it says, for by grace are you saved through faith, and that not of yourselves, it is the gift of God. This is not a New Testament concept. It is only affirming what the Torah teaches in the way in which the God of Israel delivered his people from Egypt. Now I want you to notice that it was a people who was first saved by grace through faith who came to Mount Sinai. In order to emphasize this point, did the God of Israel tell Moses, I want you to go to my people and tell them that if I observe that they're doing all my commandments exactly the way I want them to follow my commandments, and then I have no choice but deliver you out of Egypt. Is that what he said? No. Actually, the rabbis teach that the children of Israel were at the absolute lowest point of spiritual depravity. And if they went one more rung lower in spiritual depravity, there was no redemption for them. And so that is the ultimate grace. When you have gone as far as you can go and still at that point the God of Israel rescues you and pulls you from your lowly spiritual state. Now, given that we see the pattern and the picture in the Torah that there's salvation by grace through faith, and then they came to Mount Sinai, and the reason why they came to Mount Sinai was they were given instructions about how to live their lives as a redeemed people. And this is exactly what Paul was referring to in Romans chapter 3, verse 31, where he says, do we make void or do away with the Torah through faith, or because we're saved by grace through faith? He says, God forbid, we establish the Torah. What basis does he say that after we're saved by grace through faith, we establish the Torah? It comes from the Torah itself. That's how the God of Israel redeemed his people from Egypt into this pattern. But it also raises another point. How is it that if Paul explicitly asks the question, do we make void the Torah through faith, and then he answers it, so we shouldn't have any doubt of what his position is, no, we establish the Torah, why is it that he is the one that is identified as supposed? How do we get there if he, here in this verse, specifically asked the question as well as answered the question? Well, that is something that we all have to ask ourselves regarding how this came to be. I think it's because we take text out of context and we follow religious tradition. Now, in John chapter 1, verse 29, we're told that Yeshua is the Lamb of Elohim which takes away the sins of the world. And then in John chapter 14, verse 15, Yeshua said, if you love me, keep my commandments. Notice he didn't say, if you want to be saved, keep my commandments. He says, if you love me, keep my commandments. Love is something that is associated with a relationship and an intimate relationship. What he's saying is, if you follow me, if you are going to have an intimate relationship with me, then I want you to keep my commandments. You know how difficult this has been for traditional Christianity to understand what Yeshua was referring to when he said, if you love me, keep my commandments? They say, commandments, commandments, keep commandments. I wonder what he means. What in the world are commandments? And so they form a committee to investigate it, what keeping the commandments means. And all of a sudden, after studying it for a while, the committee comes back and they says, oh, we know what keeping the commandments means. It means loving Yahweh and loving everybody else. That's what he meant. Well, let's examine that thought process for a moment. Let's say, for the sake of argument, that I'm Moses. And knowing that I'm Moses, I've come down from Mount Sinai. I've been with the God of Israel up on the mount, and I have an announcement to make to you, and that is, I have commandments that I've received from the God of Israel on Mount Sinai. Would like everyone know what Moses was referring to when he says, I have commandments? If we would recognize that Moses was referring to the Torah, how come if one greater than Moses, that is Yeshua the Messiah, says, love me, keep my commandments, and all of a sudden we get amnesia? A commandment. What in the world? In the Bible is a commandment. Now let me do some heavy research now and see what a commandment is. Well, when Yeshua said, John chapter 14, verse 15, if you love me, keep my commandments, he was actually quoting from Exodus chapter 20, the chapter on giving the Ten Commandments. And in Exodus chapter 20, verse 2, it says, I am Yahweh your Elohim, which have brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. So the one that brought the children of Israel out of Egypt, and what are we told in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 4? The rock that followed them was the Messiah. So the Messiah who brought the children of Israel out of Egypt. In verse 6, he says, I show mercy, that is grace, I show mercy unto thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments. It is at Mount Sinai where you first see the phrase in the Bible, love me and keep my commandments. And it's referring to keeping the commandments that were given at Mount Sinai. So when Yeshua said, if you love me, keep my commandments, he is saying several things. First of all, he's making claim that he's the one that gave the commandments. He is the lawgiver. Now, the commandments being given to the nation of Israel was willed by the Father, but the Messiah executed the will. He actually went and did it. So Yeshua is stating that he is the lawgiver because he's calling them my commandments. He is referring, therefore, to the Torah. If you love me, follow the Torah. Because you know what happens if you don't follow the Torah? 1 John chapter 3, verse 4, sin is the transgression of the law. Because if you don't follow the law, you transgress the law, and if you transgress the law, you sin. And is a follower of Yeshua supposed to sin? No. A follower of Yeshua is supposed to walk as he walked, and Yeshua followed the Torah. Next, we're going to look that the house of Jacob was divided into two kingdoms, northern kingdom and southern kingdom. And in understanding this, we need to realize that it was Jacob's name that was changed to Israel. It was not Judah's name that was changed to Israel. Because, you see, both Jews and Christians associate the house of Jacob or Israel as being Jewish. Well, the Jewish people come from Judah, who is one of the 12 sons of Jacob. It was Jacob's name that was changed to Israel in Genesis in chapter 32. So all descendants of Jacob are Israelites. Therefore, all 12 of his sons, of course, would be named after their father, be Israelites. And the 12 tribes of Jacob ultimately got divided into northern kingdom and southern kingdom. The northern kingdom were known primarily by the names of the house of Israel, Ephraim, the house of Joseph, and Samaria. The southern kingdom were known by the term the house of Judah. Now, Judah was the leading tribe of the northern kingdom. Judah was the leading tribe of the southern kingdom. And other tribes that identified corporately with the southern kingdom was Benjamin and Levi. Now, there was an intermingling among the tribes. So, therefore, there was a minority of the 10 tribes of the northern kingdom who had intermingled and sojourned with those of the southern kingdom. But they did not constitute a large enough group to be categorized and affiliated with a tribe who sojourned with the house of Judah. Likewise, there were those of the house of Judah, that would be Benjamin, Levi, and Jews who sojourned with the northern kingdom. But they didn't constitute enough numbers to be stated as a tribal affiliated with the northern kingdom. Realizing that all those from the house of Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel, are Israelites, it would mean, therefore, that those from the southern kingdom or the house of Judah or Jews are Israelites. So all Jews, meaning everyone from the southern kingdom, is a part of the house of Jacob. So all Jews are Israelites. However, not all Israelites are Jews. Because those of the northern kingdom, that is the 10 tribes, they're Israelites because they're of the house of Jacob, but they're not Jews because Jews are identified with the house of Judah. The northern kingdom was taken captive by the Assyrians. There were three different takings of the northern kingdom by the Assyrians. And the first taking is mentioned in 2 Kings chapter 15, verse 29, which says, "In the days of Pekah, king of Israel, came Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, and he took various places, among them being Gilead and Galilee, and all the land of Naphtali, and he carried them captive to Assyria." I want you to notice that the first taking of any of the 12 tribes of Israel that is mentioned here constituted those tribes who were in the Galilee area. This is why Yeshua's ministry was centered in the Galilee, because he was stating that he was coming to repair the breach. If that's where the breach or the initial taking originally was from, he's coming to that place where the 12 tribes were originally taken from to show that he's coming to restore and to build again the tribes of Israel. The southern kingdom was taken by the Babylonians. 2 Kings chapter 24, verse 10 and verse 15, it is written, "At that time the servants of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up against Jerusalem, and the city was besieged. And he carried away Jehoiakim to Babylon, and he carried them captivity to Babylon." The northern kingdom set up what the Bible calls a golden calf system of worship. The first king of the northern kingdom was Jeroboam. The first king of the southern kingdom was Rehoboam. We're told in Deuteronomy chapter 16, verse 16, that three times a year that all the males were to go to Jerusalem to keep the feast. Jerusalem was under the jurisdiction of the southern kingdom king of Rehoboam. Therefore, those under Jeroboam's jurisdiction from the northern kingdom, if they would come to Jerusalem, they would intermingle with those of the southern kingdom or Rehoboam. Perhaps they might start talking, "How's life under your king?" Another would say, "Well, how's life under your king?" Well, if one felt that one king was more oppressive than another, or if they made friends with those of the other kingdom, they might not have their allegiance to their kings. That would be Jeroboam in this case. And so, therefore, Jeroboam did not want and take a chance for that to happen. So we're told in 1 Kings chapter 12, verses 28 and 29, that the king took counsel. He analyzed the situation, and he says, "I don't want my people to be going to Jerusalem. It's too much for you to go to Jerusalem. Behold your gods, O Israel, which brought you out of the land of Egypt." This is a quote taken from Exodus in chapter 32 regarding, in that chapter, the incident of building the golden calf. This is a quote from Exodus chapter 32 and verse 4, and it's causing the reader to take note that what Jeroboam is doing is likened unto what the children of Israel did in the wilderness when they built the golden calf. This is a golden calf system of worship. So he set up one place of worship in Bethel, and the other he put in Dan. Now, Bethel in Hebrew means the house of God. I look at it this way. They called that place they set up the house of God. But the other place is called Dan, which comes from the Hebrew word din, which means to judge. They called it the house of God, but the God of Israel was going to judge it. The book of Hosea is written as a prophecy unto the northern kingdom, speaking of their judgment for breaking the covenant at Mount Sinai, as well as their restoration and their reunification with the house of Judah. And in Hosea in chapter 1, we're told that there was a marriage that took place between Hosea and Gomer. And there are three children that are mentioned in Hosea chapter 1. And the first of the three children in Hosea chapter 1 verse 4 is named Jezreel. Jezreel means God will sow or God will scatter. And it's a prophecy that the northern kingdom would be sown or scattered among the nations. You see, the God of Israel mentioned when he brought his people to Mount Sinai that when you go into the promised land, that you are to not take after the ways of the people in the land. They'll become a snare and a trap for you. But in reading the Bible, what are we told when they went in, what they did? They made like the people around them. So the God of Israel says, okay, that's what your heart desire is to be like the people around you. That's my judgment upon you. You're going to be assimilated and you're going to become just like the people who you are desiring to be like. That is the meaning of Jezreel. The second child in Hosea chapter 1 verse 6 is named Lo Ruhamah. Lo in Hebrew is not. Ruhamah means mercy. So the second child is named No Mercy. The third child in Hosea chapter 1 verse 9 is named Lo Ami. Lo in Hebrew is not. Am in Hebrew is people. Ami is my people. So the third child is named Not My People. Well, how many of you know that if the God of Israel says to you, I'm not going to show you mercy and you are not my people, that that's not what we would call good news? However, we see a pattern in the Bible that when the God of Israel pronounces harsh words or judgment, he always ends it with words of comfort or mercy. We see this pattern in Revelation chapter 2, in Revelation chapter 3 regarding the seven churches. It begins by saying, this is what I have against you. But at the end it says, but he who overcomes. And this is a pattern, I believe, in how we are to handle our children. If we're going to rebuke them, make sure that it's followed up with words of, I love you. Because you need to let your child know that what you're doing to them, you're doing it in the context of the love that you have for them. So after, here it says, no mercy, not my people. It says in Hosea chapter 1, verse 10, yet, even though no mercy, not my people, yet the number of the children of Israel shall be as the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured nor numbered. What do you associate these words with? The covenant that was made with Abraham. In other words, what we're being told here is that through the judgment upon the northern kingdom is how the God of Israel is going to fulfill his covenant that he made with Abraham. Then it goes on to say in Hosea chapter 1 verse 10 that in the place where it was said unto them, you are not my people, where is it said that you are not my people? Right here in the book of Hosea, in proclaiming this judgment, that it will be said unto you, you are the sons of the living God. Well, who is the son of the living God? It is a term that is associated with one who is a believer that Yeshua is the Messiah. John chapter 1 verse 12 says, as many as received him, that is Yeshua the Messiah, to them gave he power to become the sons of God, or sons of the living God, even to them that believe on his name. We are told in Luke chapter 1 verse 33 that Yeshua is going to rule and reign over a redeemed house of Jacob forever, as it is written. And he, that is Yeshua, shall reign over the house of Jacob forever, and of his kingdom there will be no end. I want you to notice the name of the family of Yeshua the Messiah that he's going to rule and reign over. It is the house of Jacob. You know what that means? You better be a part of the house of Jacob, or else he's not going to rule and reign over you. But before you get nervous regarding that statement, I have very good news for you, and that is, whether you realize it or not with your mind, that the name of the redeemed family in Yeshua the Messiah is the house of Jacob. So whether in believing Yeshua is the Messiah, whether you know or realize that that is the name of your family or not, that really is the name of your family. It is the redeemed house of Jacob. We're told in Jeremiah chapter 11 verses 16 and 17 that the literal house of Jacob is likened unto an olive tree whose branches are broken, as it is written. Yahweh called your name a green olive tree, and the branches of this green olive tree are broken. And then we're told in Jeremiah chapter 11, verse 17, that this olive tree is the house of Israel and the house of Judah. So we're told that there's a green olive tree, who's the house of Israel and the house of Judah, and its branches are broken because they broke the covenant at Mount Sinai. Well, how in the world are these broken branches going to get mended or repaired? And that is what Paul explains in Romans chapter 11. Remember now, in Jeremiah chapter 11, verses 16 and 17, we're referring to the literal house of Jacob, consisting of the literal house of Israel and the literal house of Judah. In Romans chapter 11, Paul explains regarding the redeemed olive tree. That is an olive tree that believes in Yeshua as Messiah. It consists of wild branches and natural branches. And what we need to understand, as we're told in Romans chapter 11, that both the wild branches and the natural branches are grafted in. We are told in Romans in chapter 11 and verse 17 that the wild branches are grafted in, and many non-Jews are familiar that they are grafted in. But what we have missed in our understanding is that we're told in Romans chapter 11 verse 24 that when the natural branches believe, they will be grafted into their own olive tree. So do you realize that all believers in Yeshua as the Messiah are grafted in? And see, because we haven't been taught, it hasn't been emphasized, that the natural branches are grafted in when they believe, there are some non-Jews who have it in their mind that they think that somehow they're second class to the nation of Israel, or even Jewish believers, because we're just only grafted in. You're like the real thing. No, both are just grafted in. Romans 11, verse 17, the wild branches. Romans 11, verse 24, the natural branches. Now, I'm going to show you something very interesting regarding the term that is used for this grafting process. It is spelled in English S-C-I-O-N, which is related to the Hebrew word zion. So the term for when the graft actually takes place is zion, or we more commonly say it in English, Zion. So when and how is this olive tree going to be made one of Messiah? It happens through the birth and the creation of Zion in the end of days. Next, we need to realize that the new covenant was only made with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. You see, virtually all of non-Jewish believers in Yeshua as the Messiah, who refer to themselves as Christian, understand that we are in the new covenant. And when Yeshua shed his blood on the tree, he ushered in the new covenant. But we do not associate and identify with who this new covenant was made with. The new covenant was only made with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. And how do you become a part of that covenant? We just went over it in Romans 11. You got to be grafted in. So if you are in the new covenant, which was only made with the house of Israel and the house of Judah, and you are grafted in the covenant, guess who you become a part of? The house of Israel or the house of Judah. Now, if you are a Jewish believer in Yeshua as Messiah, you are grafted into the Jewish side of the family. That is the redeemed house of Judah. If you are non-Jewish, you are grafted into the non-Jewish side of the family, which is the redeemed house of Israel. So Paul is referring in Romans chapter 11 to ultimately the believers in Yeshua as the Messiah, consisting of the redeemed house of Israel and the redeemed house of Judah. Now let's focus our attention on the non-Jewish side of the family of Yeshua as the Messiah. That would be the redeemed house of Israel. It would consist of two groups of people. Remember the prophecy in Hosea chapter 1 that those who were not a people were going to become sons of the living Elohim? That prophecy was to a literal physical people. In order for that prophecy to be fulfilled, there must be present believers in Yeshua as the Messiah who are physical descendants from the northern kingdom. However, you remember when the God of Israel brought redemption to his people, bringing them out of Egypt, that there was also those who were not physically descended from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the mixed multitude that the Torah teaches that were permitted to participate in the redemption. That was primarily to and for the fulfillment of the covenant made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Therefore, in that same pattern in the renewed covenant, those from among the nations are permitted to accept the redemption that Yeshua provided when he shed his blood on the tree. And the book of John refers to all those who would do that as whosoevers, for whosoever would believe that Yeshua is the Messiah would have everlasting life. That we have those from the nations, when they believe that Yeshua is Messiah, they become members of the redeemed house of Israel. That is the non-Jewish side of the family. That being the case, realizing that the redeemed house of Israel consists of non-Jews who are physically descended from the northern kingdom and non-Jews who are physically from the nations, would an individual non-Jewish believer in Yeshua as Messiah know whether they were physically descended from the northern kingdom or from the nations? An individual believer would not. But would it matter as it relates to being a member of the family of Messiah whether you are physically from the northern kingdom or from the nations? And the answer is no. Why would it not matter as you as an individual whether you are physically descended from the northern kingdom if you're non-Jewish or from the nations? It's because the congregation of Messiah is a family of firstborn. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 23. You've come to the general assembly and congregation of the firstborn. Now, in the Torah, the firstborn has the birthright. And in 1 Chronicles chapter 5, verse 1, it says the birthright was given to the sons of Joseph, the sons of Israel, and genealogy is not to be reckoned after the birthright. And so the family of Messiah is not based upon genealogy. You cannot become a member of the family of Messiah because your great-great-grandparents believe that Yeshua was the Messiah and you're descended from them. No. You, as an individual, must choose to receive Yeshua into your heart and your life to become a member of his family. Now let's look at the literal house of Jacob today, who we're going to personify as being the Jewish people, because the northern kingdom got assimilated in the nations. We can't identify who specifically they are. And personifying the literal house of Jacob as being Jews, do Jews believe that Yeshua is Messiah? Well, some Jews believe that Yeshua is Messiah. I know Jewish believers, but most Jews don't believe that Yeshua is the Messiah. Let's look at the situation of the redeemed house of Jacob, commonly called Christianity. Do the majority of people in the redeemed house of Jacob believe and understand that loving Yeshua and keeping his commandments means that they should follow Torah? The answer is some do. We primarily call those who are identifying with that as those who are embracing their Hebrew roots. We believe in keeping the Sabbath and the festivals and the dietary laws and the commandments of the Torah. So some do believe they should express their faith in Yeshua this way, but most people who identify themselves and refer as Christians, most don't believe that they should keep the Sabbath and the festivals and the dietary laws and generally follow what they call the ceremonial aspects of the Torah and being a believer in Yeshua's Messiah. Therefore, the house of Jacob is divided today in that most of the literal house of Jacob don't believe that Yeshua is Messiah. And most of the redeemed house of Jacob don't believe that they should express their faith in Yeshua as the Messiah by following Torah. So how is this resolved? It is resolved through the ministry of Elijah in the end of days. We see the purpose and the function of the ministry of Elijah in Malachi chapter 4, verses 4 and 5, where it is written, "Remember ye the Torah of Moses my servant," that is the subject or the context, and regarding remembering the Torah of Moses my servant, it says, "Behold, I send you Elijah the prophet." Why is Elijah the prophet being sent? It is with the message of, "Remember ye the Torah of Moses." But when is Elijah the prophet sent? Before the coming and great and dreadful day of the Lord. Well, the day of the Lord is the Messianic era. And most of the Messianic era, Messiah is ruling and reigning in the earth after he set his feet down the Mount of Olives. But the darkness part of the day of Yahweh, commonly called the tribulation, is the great and dreadful day of the Lord period of time. So before the tribulation, we're told that Elijah would have a message of remember the Torah of Moses. Is there a message going forth in the body of Messiah today encouraging and exhorting believers in Yeshua that they need to follow Torah, meaning they need to identify with the Sabbath and the festivals and eating right and other elements and aspects of Torah commandments that have been neglected? Yes. And what is the name given to this movement? We call it the Hebraic Roots of Christianity. This, I believe, is a movement that personifies the spirit of Elijah in the end of days. And so, therefore, if we really are at the tribulation days and times, and we are actually close to Yeshua returning and setting his feet down on the Mount of Olives, we should see the ministry of Elijah that precedes his coming, because we're told in Matthew chapter 17, beginning in verse 10, when Yeshua was asked, "Why is it said that Elijah must come first?" And he said, "Elijah will come and restore all things," referring to the time prior to his second coming. And so the fact that we have a voice that is crying in the body of Messiah that we need to follow Torah, I believe, is evidence that we are nearing the coming of the Messiah. So ultimately, how does this restoration look like when it takes place? Ezekiel in chapter 37 and verse 16. How does this restoration look like when it ultimately takes place? In Ezekiel chapter 37, verse 16, it says, "Son of man, take you one stick." The word stick in Hebrew is eitz, which really means tree. If you translate it literally, it says, "Take one tree and write upon it for Judah and for the children of Israel, his companions. Then take another eitz, or tree, and write upon it for Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, and for all the house of Israel, his companions." So we're told that we are to take two trees. Anyone have any idea what tree that this is referring to? How about an olive tree? Take two olive trees and make those two olive trees one tree. Well, how are you going to make two olive trees one tree? You got to graft them. Make the two olive trees one tree, and they will become one in your hand. Make the two olive trees one tree, and they will become one in your hand. And then it goes on to say that when they are united and become one, it says in Ezekiel 37, verse 22, I will make them one nation in the land upon the mountains of Israel. The mountains of Israel is also referred to in the Bible as Judea and Samaria, and it's commonly called in the Western world the West Bank. This is one of the designated places for the return of the exiles, and that is upon the mountains of Israel. Well, what do we know about the mountains of Israel? The mountains of Israel is where the settlers are, and this is the area which Israel is negotiating to create and make a Palestinian state. And when they do that, the settlers upon the mountains of Israel will then have to be removed from their homes, even as those in the Gaza were removed from their homes in August of 2005. It is also upon the mountains of Israel where the Gog-Magog invasion takes place. And so the very place that the world wants to create a Palestinian state and to remove Jews from their homes is one of the designated places that the God of Israel says, when I end the exile and gather my people from all the nations where I've scattered them, I'm going to bring them back to that very place as a statement that I am King of the universe. I do govern the affairs that happen upon the earth. Kings of the earth are subject to me and my will, and I'm going to show the world that I made a covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and I'm going to bring my people back to the mountains of Israel. This takes place in the context of what the Bible calls in Isaiah in chapter 34 and verse 8, the mountains. This is in the context of what the Bible calls in Isaiah chapter 34, verse 8, the controversy of Zion. And ultimately, when the exiles of Israel are gathered back to, among other places, the mountains of Israel, when Northern Kingdom and Southern Kingdom are united, when they've been grafted together and made one, this is a work of the Messiah. And he's going to set his feet down on the Mount of Olives when this reunification takes place. He's going to set up his kingdom, and the redeemed of Israel will be the head of all nations, and their job task is to teach Messiah's Torah to the nations. For it is written in Ezekiel chapter 37, verse 24, "And David my servant shall be king over them, and they will have one shepherd. They will walk in my judgments, observe my statutes, and do them." Notice that there's going to be one king and one shepherd. Judaism identifies the God of Israel as being the king of the universe. Christianity, through Yeshua, the Messiah, identifies him with being the good shepherd. Notice they're going to have one king and one shepherd. And that one king and shepherd is Yeshua the Messiah. He is going to rule and reign over a redeemed Northern Kingdom and Southern Kingdom, united. They're going to recognize that he's the Messiah, and they're going to be following his Torah. Thus, this is the understanding of who is the house of Jacob. There's a literal house of Jacob. There's a redeemed house of Jacob. Messiah redeemed the literal house of the lawgiver that gave the Torah to the literal house of Jacob at Mount Sinai. They broke his covenant, so he came and died, shed his blood to forgive the sins of the literal house of Jacob. And when they repent of their sins, accept him as the Messiah, they become a part of his redeemed family, along with all the whosoevers in the world who also believes that Yeshua is the Messiah. And thus, the name of this redeemed family is the redeemed house of Jacob, known as the olive tree family of Messiah, in Romans in chapter 11. I pray that this message has been a rich blessing to you. Remember always these words from 1 John in chapter 2 and verse 6. He who says he abides in him, he who says that he is a believer in Yeshua as the Messiah, I himself so to walk even as he walked. And how did Yeshua walk or live his life? He followed the commandments or the Torah of his father. Even so, we are commanded to do likewise. For Yeshua said, if you love me, keep my commandments. Shalom in Yeshua the Messiah. Amen.